Argentina's new president, Mr. Javier Milei, is unlike any political leader in Argentina's history. Have you watched videos of his political rallies, during which he wields a running chainsaw? He wants to trim the government, cut state subsidies, get rid of Argentina's peso, and adopt the US dollar instead as Argentina's national currency, and much more.
I think it's not possible right now, because imagine if you want to dollarize the economy, the first thing that you need is dollars.
Of course.
Actually, you need a huge amount of dollars because you have to change the whole amount of pesos that you have to dollars.
What's Argentina's inflation rate now?
Well, the last month was 25% for the month.
For the month?
Your real salary is not the salary that you are agreeing at the beginning of the contract. Your real salary is the average of the salary that you are going to have over the year. But because you are not very able to compare between prices, because are changing all the time, the power that the store have increased a lot. So actually, in high inflation, we see that the markups of the stores increase because they have more power, because the cost of searching prices increase a lot for consumers.
So when you say Argentinians have savings in dollars outside the banking system, so where do they save their money?
Under the mattress.
Seriously?
Under the couch. Or maybe you have like a security box in the bank that it's different to have a saving account. Imagine if I want to buy a home in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
I can't go to the bank and ask for a loan. There is not credit for that. So I have to save my own money under my mattress for so many years until I get the amount of dollars that I need to buy the house. So it's very difficult to progress in the economy of this. During most of this century, we were the richest economies in Latin America. Now we are not anymore. It's Chile, the richest economy in Latin America.
Did you know that in its history, Argentina has defaulted on its national debt 9 times, including 3 times in just the last couple of decades? In comparison, the United States has never defaulted on its debt. So one reason that America has a much higher debt to GDP ratio than Argentina is that while investors are reluctant to lend to Argentina, they will readily lend to America, knowing that we'll pay it back in full with interest. Hey there, News Peelers. Today is February 7, 2024, and this is Adele, your host at the History Behind News podcast. Aren't you tired of the repetitive news on TV and social media? They just go over the same dramatized developments all day long. Do you ever wonder what happened before our news? I mean, how did we get here? They say if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. So while others cover the news, I uncover its history. I call this peeling the history behind news, which we accomplish in weekly conversations with distinguished scholars who delve deep into history to give us their fascinating perspectives from our past. I'm committed to making in-depth history that are researched and written by scholars enjoyable and accessible to everyone. So grab a cup of coffee or your favorite drink, or both, and let's get into it. Just a few days ago, massive protests erupted in Argentina against President Milei's economic reforms and austerity measures, including privatization and the cutting of state subsidies. I first read about Argentina's newly elected president back in November in the New York Times, and there was a lot to digest about him. For example, he's a self-styled anarcho-capitalist, which means that he's probably anti-statist. He likely believes in libertarian political philosophy and economic theory, which favors stateless societies and an economic system predicated on private property. in addition to declaring that he would get rid of Argentina's peso for the US dollar, which is quite a radical proposition, he has made many other bold promises and proclamations. Just take this statement he made during his campaign. Quote, closing Argentina's central bank is a moral obligation. End quote. But how much this anarcho-capitalist beliefs and rhetoric President Milei will actually get to implement? Well, according to the BBC, President Milei has warned that unless his far-reaching economic reforms are implemented, Argentina would suffer, quote, a social catastrophe of biblical proportions, end quote. And in a recent Wall Street Journal interview, he said he has no plan B for the economy. This is it. He's pushing ahead. I know there's a lot to unpack here. So, to better understand Argentina's economic challenges and history, I spoke with Dr. Gabriel Platzo. He's a development economist from Latin America exploring questions crucial to improving quality of life and well-being in developing economies. He is a research officer at the Institute of Development Studies in England, and prior to this appointment, he was a professor of advanced macroeconomics at the University of Buenos Aires. To learn more about Dr. Palazzo, you can visit his homepage, the link for which is provided in the detailed caption of this episode. So, stay with me as Dr. Palazzo and I peel the history behind this news. U.S. forces are fighting a proxy war with Iran. We're carrying out strikes against targets in Syria, Iraq, and also in Yemen. But did you know that before Iran's 1979 revolution, America hardly had any military presence in the Middle East?
We had been counting on the Shah to be a stabilizing force in the region. When he is overthrown and replaced by anti-American radicals, then expectations that we're going to get any help from Iran disappear. In many respects, now the expectation is Iran has become a problem.
And if you think the conflict in the Middle East is an issue for far distant lands, detached and irrelevant to our lives here in America, well, think again.
But that's a domestic concern.
Exactly the point. In other words, that if we really want to understand the impact of our military involvement, foreign policy involvement in the Middle East, I think we need to look at our domestic situation.
I spoke to Dr. Andrew Bacevich at Unraveling the Middle East podcast about how and when America became militarily entangled in the Middle East. Dr. Bacevich is co-founder and chairman of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's Professor Emeritus of International Relations and History at Boston University. He's a graduate of West Point, a Vietnam War veteran, and a retired colonel of the U.S. Army. He has written many books, including America's War for the Greater Middle East. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Bacevich. Now, let's start our conversation with Dr. Palazzo about Argentina's economic challenges. Dr. Palazzo, it's a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you for taking the time for this conversation with me. I was reviewing Argentina's financial history, economic history, and I noted that Argentina has experimented with several different types of pesos. And I'll just share their sort of acronyms here. ARL, ARP, ARA, and now ARS. Without getting into too much detail, why change the currency so many times?
First of all, thank you for having me in the program. It's my pleasure to be talking with you. And the thing is, we are having problems with inflation rates for so long that even that during different time, we don't have a very high rate of inflation, but the still inflation is much higher than in the United States and all and other countries or the developed countries. So it's at some moment we realize that we say, okay, our currency is not very valued, so we don't want to have such amount of zero against next to our prices. So we say, okay, maybe we have to start again and say, okay, now we take out all these zeros and start over again, and we change the currency for that reason. So most of the time, the changes of the currency are because deflation rate makes that doesn't have any sense to continue having that currency, and the prices increases in that.
So currency. So let's say something that is now, let's say, 10,000 pesos. You change the currency, now it becomes 10 pesos, something like that, right?
Actually, that's perfect. In one moment, we say 10,000 pesos, it's going to be one austral or one peso or different kind of peso. So that's why we change the currency so much and so many times.
One thing about the current currency that was interesting to me is that it's called is referred to as peso convertible. I don't appreciate what that term means, convertible, in this context. Aren't all currencies convertible in essence?
Well, that's interesting, because despite we call it that way, now you can't convert the peso to other currencies.
You cannot?
No, actually not. That's why we have a black market in currency. I mean, if you go to Argentina and you go to the bank with your dollars, they're going to give you much less pesos. Instead, if you go to another place that probably is not legal to change your dollars to pesos. But I mean, this is not like a crime. If you go to a restaurant, they're going to pay much more pesos for each dollar than in the bank, because we have capital controls that says, okay, not everyone with pesos or with dollar can change the currency in the official exchange rates. That's fun, because I mean, I didn't know before your question, I didn't know that we call convertible peso.
But
of course, in the past was convertible, and it's just, I don't know, probably, well, right now is more or less 12 years before was full convertible, but since 2011 we put this capital control, so are not convertible anymore.
So we're going to get to capital controls in the next segment. That's really interesting. But so we have, even though they call it a peso convertible, it's not convertible in reality. Your new president, Mr. Javier Milei, ran on a campaign of adopting the US dollar as Argentina's currency. And I started communicating with you back then to set this, scheduled this podcast conversation with you. And that stuck with me. One, is he going to go through with it? And two, is that even practical?
Well, it's a very important question. I think that it's not. I think it's not possible right now, because imagine if you want to dollarize the economy, the first thing that you need is dollars.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Actually, you need a huge amount of dollars, because you have to change the whole amount of pesos that you have to dollars. So if you don't have dollars, you cannot do that at all. No, that's a fact. If you have a very small amount of dollars in the international in the central bank as reserves, maybe you can change all the amount of pesos to dollars, but using a very high very high exchange rate. So that means that you need a very huge depreciation of the currency. That happened in the past, but it's not enough, because at the beginning of the government of Milei, we have a very huge depreciation of our currency, but it still is not enough in order to change all of our liabilities in pesos to dollars. Indeed, in Argentina, we say that we have negative international reserves.
That negative? Means
that the central bank has more liabilities in dollars than the amount of assets in dollars that they have. So it's almost impossible to dollarize the economy right now in this moment. The only possibility if someone, for example, the IMF or another international organization or the Federal Reserve of the United States, give us a loan, a big loan, to try to change, to increase our reserves and then change all our liabilities in pesos to dollars. But right now it's impossible. Impossible, but also it's not desirable. I mean, we don't want economies are against to change most of the economies, so the mainstream economies are against to change our currency to dollars, because that's going to mean that we are losing our sovereignty.
I actually thought about that. It's an interesting point that you bring up with respect to losing sovereignty. Let me just think this out loud with you and tell me if this scenario is actually something that you're concerned about when it comes to sovereignty. If Argentina adopts the US dollar wholesale, let's say it's possible for the sake of argument, and then our Federal Reserve here in the United States changes interest rates, goes up and goes down. They do it for the benefit of the United States. They don't do it for the benefit of Argentina. And that's going to mess up your economy every time. In effect, you are, as a country, Argentina is going to be bound by the decisions of another country's central bank.
Yeah, no, doesn't make any sense from the economic point of view. I'm going to explain why I think that it's a bad idea, but then I'm going to try to explain why some economies or maybe the president Javier Milei thinks that it is a good idea.
Yeah, please.
I think that it is a bad idea because the thing that you are saying, our economic cycles are not synchronized. I mean, the economic cycle in Argentina, it's very different than the economic cycle of the United States. Our economy depends on the price of the soybeans, for example, and that's not the case in United States. So maybe when your economy is booming and you need, and maybe you are having an increase in inflation rate, you are going to want to increase the interest rate just to try to slow down inflation, but that actually is going to decrease the prices of soybeans in international markets because are negative correlated with the interest
rate. The Federal Reserve's move to decrease inflation may work for America, but it may be actually a detriment to Argentina based on the example.
Yeah, and actually, it's going to harm a lot of Argentina because it's going to decrease the prices of the commodity that we export, and also is going to increase the price that we have to pay for our debt, are going to increase the foreign interest rate that we have to pay our foreign debt.
Also, that's a double whammy. Now your debt is going to be more expensive because interest rates are higher and your debts are in dollars in that case, in that hypothetical.
That's the thing. So our economic cycles are not synchronized. So it doesn't make any sense to give the possibility to do monetary policy to the United States, because you are going to do whatever is better for you, and probably it's not going to be the same that we need to do in that moment.
Go ahead.
No, what is the argument that other economies are saying about, okay, maybe it's a good idea, and economies that is next or close to Javier Milei, or indeed Javier Milei too, they say, okay, the problem is that we're not being very good doing monetary policy. No, that's a fact. I mean, we have the highest rate of inflation of the world in 2023. So they say, why do you want to have the control of your monetary policy if years after years and decade after decade, you realize that for some reason that maybe we don't have a good justification, we're not good doing that. So that's, I mean, it's fair to say that. It's fair to say, okay, you don't want to have the control if you are not using very well. But it's still, at least for me as an scorer and as a researcher, is okay, but shall we give up? Or maybe we should try to understand why we're not doing so very well with why we are not doing our monetary policy very well and try to change. Because I want at the end of I want that my grandchildren at least live in a better country than the one that is Argentina right now, in that Argentina get developed at some point. I don't think that adopting the US currency is going to be the way to develop the country. So I think that we should not give up and try to start doing the thing well. And actually, the rest of the countries in Latin America had the same problems in the past, and they managed to solve it. They managed to solve the inflation rate, and they managed to do monetary policy in a smart way. And so why we can't do it? There is something that we're missing, but I'm optimistic that in the future we can do it.
First of all, I love what you said, that you want to give a better Argentina to your grandchildren than the one you have now. And hopefully you will succeed, you and your countrymen and women will succeed in that. I want to make sure that I understand the argument that President Milei and his economic advisors are putting forth for adopting the US dollar, as you shared with me. They're basically saying that, look, and I'm just paraphrasing, please correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Palazzo. They're saying that basically, look, for whatever reason, in recent decades, us Argentinians, the leaders, the elites of Argentina, have not been good at managing our economy and inflation. So let's base our monetary system on someone else who's managing theirs well. Is that the thrust of the argument?
Yeah, I think so.
That's crazy. That means that you can't experiment. Argentinian economists cannot experiment with their own economy anymore because the currency belongs to someone else and is managed by someone else.
Yeah, I mean, it means that we're giving up. I mean, that's the meaning of that. It's okay, we can do it. It's just, we can do it. So maybe it's that's better crazy. For us to give someone else the power to do the monetary policy for us. And of course, they have another argument that is associated with this, is, okay, Argentinian citizens already choose the currency that they want to have. Because if you check the statistics, most of the Argentinian saves in dollars. I mean, we don't save in our own currency because
which makes sense because there's inflation, right?
There is inflation, and we have a long history of, for example, big devaluations, big depreciation of the currency. So our if you want to buy an apartment or a floor in Argentina, you have to pay in dollars. The prices are in dollars. So, of course, if your dream is to have your own home in the future, you know that you have to save an amount of dollars. So if that's your goal, probably you're saying, okay, I would like to start increasing my savings and having some dollars, and probably outside the bank system, because we also in 2001, at some point we say, I mean, the government kept the savings account the thing is, during the 90s we say 1 peso, $1, and people trust the banks and put pesos and dollars in the saving accounts. And at some point we say, okay, we cannot give you back dollars for your pesos because we don't have enough dollars. So at that moment we say, okay, you can take away any saving from your saving accounts, because that's going to break, it's going to be a breakdown of the banking system. So at that moment people lose a lot of money and so on. So of course citizens in Argentina do not trust the banking system, do not trust our currency, and try to save in dollars.
So the banking system in Argentina is saying, we don't want to run on the bank, like, you know, where you take out all the money. So you have money here, but you don't have access to all of it, at least. So when you say Argentinians have savings in dollars outside the banking system, so where do they save their money, if not in the banking system?
Under the mattress.
Seriously?
Under the couch. Yeah, and no, that's, I mean, that's true. I mean, or maybe you have like a security box in the bank that it's different to have a saving account. It's security box in the banks means that it's yours and you have the key and so on. But that's great. I mean, that's a big problem, because why is it a big problem? If you think that for getting your country in a better position and manage to develop in the future, you need to invest in machineries, in roads, and so on. To invest, you need savings.
Yeah.
You need funding for investments. So if the citizens of your country are not relying on the bank systems and are keeping the saving outside the system, then you don't have enough money to invest.
So
in the real economy, so it's a problem.
What you're saying is that if the citizenry does not give its money to the banking system, then a bank in return doesn't have enough money to lend to other companies to go out, buy, let's say, tractors, buy, invest in buildings, buy. So the economy, there's not enough money to grease the wheels of the economy in the banking system, in the financial system, because people are not putting into the currency of the banking system.
That's right. Right. Wow. Imagine this. I mean, imagine if I want to buy a home in Argentina.
Uh-huh.
I can't go to the bank and ask for a loan. There is not credit for that. So I have to save my own money under my mattress for so many years until I get the amount of dollars that I need to buy the house. So it's very difficult to progress in the economy of this, because
Dr. Palazzo, how does that work? How could, let's say you need to buy $1 million home. I'm just using a very easy number. Yeah. Like, you know, you literally have to save $1 million in cash to buy that house?
For most of the people, that's the case.
That means most people don't get to buy a home then.
Yeah, that's very problematic. I mean, if you don't have parents that have a very good position in the past and they can lend you money and help you, it's very difficult to buy a house. I mean, we have some where there was some moments that we managed to create an instrument that helped people to have mortgages and so on, but I mean, I'm 36.
Wow, that causes
that's
a lot
only
of
been 4 years.
For 4 years, is that what you said?
Yeah, the only possibility to have a mortgage is at a reasonable price and interest rate was only for 4 years in a very specific moment, or 2 years actually, and then it's like it's impossible. So it's a big problem that you don't have a very deep banking system that citizens of your country trust, because at the end it's what you say, you need this in order to the economy works, because
to grease the economy. Now without the mortgage system in America, just most Americans won't be able to buy a home. That creates huge socioeconomic issues. That's interesting. I just wanted to ask a very brief question in the minute we have left of this segment. You talked about other Latin American countries who have had this issue. I don't want to go there so much as to ask about, I've heard that this other Latin American countries in Argentina at some point were talking about creating a unified currency system. Have you heard of it? It's called Mercosur. Am I saying that correctly?
I mean, Mercosur is a trade agreement between some of the countries. It's
okay.
We don't have a common currency. And there was an idea that created a common currency between maybe Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay, that are the four principal members of the Mercosur. But I don't think that's, it's not even close to that, to happen that, because it's, in order to do that, I mean, why, I mean, there is one reason why Argentina may want to do it. It's the same reason as these economies close to Milei can say, okay, we're not very good doing our monetary policy, so maybe we can use the monetary policy of Brazil that it seems is better than ours. And still, the economic cycle of Brazil is closer to Argentina than the economic cycle of the United States. So probably when the economy is going very well in Brazil, it's also going very well in Argentina, because we rely on the same goods, we export the same goods, and so on. So makes more sense. But I don't know if Brazil wants to have the same currency as Argentina. So it's, you need two to tango.
Exactly. And you saying that from Argentina, the capital of tango, that makes a lot of sense. So we'll be back after a short break to talk about Argentina's hyperinflation. In this episode, Dr. Palazzo makes several references to the country of Chile, Argentina's neighbor, whose economy is now more advanced than Argentina's. But as you will know from my conversation with Dr. Claudio Fuentes in Season 2, Episode 38, Chile has been grappling with its own constitutional crisis.
The indigenous rights, the idea of nationhood, this idea of plurinationalistic way of thinking of the state will divide us. It's not the Chile is one nation. It's not, we are not a set of several nations with the indigenous.
Yeah.
So we are only one nation. So the conservative argument was very effective and mobilized a lot of people.
Dr. Fuentes is a professor at the School of Political Science at the Diego Portales University in Chile. In 2015, he was a member of Chile's Presidential Anti-Corruption Advisory Council. He's an associate researcher at the Center for Intercultural and Indigenous Studies and coordinates the Constitutional Laboratory at Diego Portales University. I've dropped a link for you to my conversation with Dr. Fuentes. Now, let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Palazzo about Argentina's economy. Dr. Palazzo, in the last segment, we talked about inflation quite a bit. I would be remiss if I don't ask this question. What's Argentina's inflation rate now?
On the last month was 25% for the month.
For the month?
Yeah, that's... Wow. So during the last year was 240%. So this is very high inflation rate. Yeah.
Wow. How I'm speechless here. How do Argentinians deal with that 25% grocery? I mean, give me some examples of what happens on a day-to-day basis. Like when you get your paycheck, do you run and shop before?
Well, actually, yes. I mean, it's very interesting. We call this high inflation. I know that in the United States, you call high inflation like 10% per year, but we call over 100% per year high inflation in Latin America. And the interesting thing that people get used to live with inflation. So we manage to deal with the problem that inflation causes, and we get used. For example, of course, our wages are increased several times per year, and if the inflation rate is higher, you need like probably every month to have an increase in your wages, because Imagine what happened if in January the wages are not increasing. You are losing 25% of the purchasing power that you have. Now you can buy 25% less of goods and services. So it doesn't make any sense, and it's very problematic. So we start creating this indexation of the economy that makes that everything get every price get increased several times per year. The bad thing of that is makes very difficult then to decrease inflation, because imagine that for the last month we have 25% of inflation. So imagine that the next month wages increase 25% of 25% just to not lose to the last inflation rate.
Yeah.
But then the cost of the firms are increasing more or less 25%, because wages are also part of the cost of the firms.
So they increase the prices of their goods and services.
So they increase again. So that's creates what we call chronic inflation. That means that the inflation of today is explained by the inflation of yesterday or the last month. So makes that the inflation rate get to a level very high, and it's very difficult to decrease the inflation rate only using monetary policy, because you have this indexation of the contracts of the economy that create that the inflation rate is very sticky.
I have so many questions to ask, especially being an American and I'm familiar with these sort of rates of inflation and chronic inflation. You were talking about wages. So let's say you want to hire me at the University of Buenos Aires, your employer up to just a few months ago. And I come there and you say, okay, Adele, we love you. We want you to come to our Department of History. What's my salary? If you say, okay, $100,000, let's just pick a round number, that salary doesn't make sense, because it'll have to be $125,000 in a month, and then the next month. Like, how do you pick us? How do we agree on a salary?
And it's complicated. Everything is complicated. It's not salaries, but every prices. But salary, for example, the smartest thing that you should ask is how many times per year are you going to
raise?
To raise my salary. That's a very important question, because imagine that they offer a very high salary at the beginning.
Yeah.
But they only going to raise your salary next year.
Well, now so, you're falling behind inflation.
Very, very. So actually, your salary, your real salary, is not the salary that you are agreeing at the beginning of the contract. Your real salary is the average of the salary that you are going to have over the year, or between the moments that they are going to increase the salary. Because
so you're actually agreeing to a salary range, not a number. It's a range. That's
the thing. Every contract that lasts for more than 1 month, it's going to decrease the real price, because the inflation rate is going to continue. So you need to be very aware. The same happens if you want to. I don't know if you want to go and rent an apartment. You have to agree how many times they are going to increase the amount that you have to pay for the apartment, because it's not the same. I mean, it's very tricky. So you have to do a lot of thinking around, looking if the deal is good for you or not. But this happened in everything, because imagine the other situation that happened in high inflation, no? Imagine that you go to a store that you want to buy, I don't know, meat, for example, that we are very good with meat.
Yeah.
Maybe you go through the door and you see the prices and you don't know if the prices of that store is very high, or it's just because all the prices of meat around the core, around the city increase. So the thing is, you go through the door, you see the prices, and you don't know if the prices are right, are fair, or so on, because you don't know what are the normal prices anymore. Because maybe the meat now value $10, I don't know, but maybe it's that's the value in every store, or maybe it's just that store that it's very expensive. But because you are not very able to compare between prices, because are changing all the time, the power that the store have increased a lot. So actually, in high inflation, we see that the markups of the stores increase because they have more power, because the cost of searching prices increase a lot for consumers.
This is crazy, Dr. Palazzo. You can't here in the U.S., well, we're experiencing inflation, nothing compared to yours, but family, my mother, wife, mother-in-law, father-in-law, we always talk about different prices. But if it's changing so much, those conversations don't make sense anymore.
No, that's the thing. I mean, there is something. I mean, I'm sure that if you ask to any Argentinian living in Argentina right now, they don't know what is the price of milk, for example, just a basic food that we buy every week, because it's changing all the time. So you don't know, and because you don't know what is the price, you can't compare. So that there is a funny story. My girlfriend is from Spain, and we met in the United States, and we went back to Spain one day. Two years, she was living 1 year in the United States, and she arrived to the beach house that she has with her parents has, and she remember how much cost a pastry there. So for me in Argentina, it's impossible. You can't remember how much.
She returned after some time, like a year or so, and she still knew the price of pastry over there. Is that what you said?
Yeah. So she can't. I mean, if you go to a new store, she can compare, because she can say, okay, no, this is expensive, so I'm not going to buy you the pastry.
Wow.
But that's not happening in high inflation. That's impossible. You can't know if you are buying if the price is very expensive, or if all the prices increases at the same time. So actually, when you have this high inflation, what happened is the dispersion of prices is so high, the variance of prices. So maybe one store charge for a milk a very high price and another a very lower price, and you're never sure if what you are paying is fair, or it's just very cheap or very expensive. That's a big problem.
Okay, I have a lot of questions to ask about what you share with me, these different scenarios, but I'm not going to do that. I want to talk about something that you mentioned during a break. You used this term, stabilization plans.
Yeah.
What is that? Does that have to do with everything we talked about, inflation?
Yes, of course. I mean, stabilization plans is what countries have done in the past to deal with these scenarios of high inflation.
Now, okay.
When you have an inflation that is higher than 50% per year, for example, much higher than what we are experiencing right now in the United States, it seems that you can't stop inflation just doing monetary policy. It seems that you need
something. By monetary policy, you mean pumping more money into the system, taking it out, or changing interest rates
and so on. It's like you need like a whole economic program to deal with different aspects of the economy that are not doing very well. Because actually, this is, of course, the thing is, in this situation, a lot of macroeconomic fundamentals, macroeconomic accounts like the fiscal balance, the trade account or the current account and so on, are in disequilibrium. You have problems there. You have a very big fiscal deficit, and you also maybe have, probably you have capital control, so you have like a black market of the exchange rate, so you don't have only one exchange rate, so you have a lot of problems. So you need to change everything at the same time in order to have a chance to stop this inflation rate.
Kind of like a reboot of the whole system.
It's like reboot the whole system, because actually what you most need in this situation is that the expectations of people change and the behavior of people change. We were talking about in high inflation, the economy start a period of indexation of every prices.
Yeah, no? Yeah.
So that's a problem, because if the present is caused by the past, if in the past I have 25% of inflation, and that's going to cost that in the future I also have 25% of inflation because the wages are increasing, and because the wages are increasing, the costs are increasing, and because the costs are increasing, the prices should increase in order to keep the markup constant. So if that is the case, it's a problem. Because it's like it's permanent. It's very difficult to stop that kind of inflation. So in a stabilization plan, you need to convince everyone that the future are going to be different than the past.
How do you do that?
Well, doing a stabilization plan, but actually, in our investigations and in our research with Martin Rapetti and Joaquin Wellman, we checked all the stabilization plans that happens between 1970 to 2020, that in Latin America, that in total were 46 stabilization plans. And of that 46 stabilization plan, only 12 were successful.
You mean or 60?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, say again.
How many stabilization plans did you look at? 6 or 60?
46.
46. Okay. And only 12 of them were successful. Okay. So
that is more or less the 25%.
Yeah. But still a chance. It's better than giving your currency to another country.
Still a chance. And actually, what we see, if you manage to do an stabilization plan, a successful stabilization plan, the economy increase, the GDP start growing quite high. So it's very interesting. It's something that
now,
we desire.
This is something that you and your colleagues in Argentina have academically researched. Is this something that the government is interested in or has contacted you about? Is this something that's in the political discourse?
It's something that was in the presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. During the campaign was something that the different candidates were discussing. This president has his own stabilization plan that rely on the dollarization of the economy.
Yeah.
The dollarization of the economy could be a stabilization plan. And actually, one of the stabilization plan that we studied was the dollarization of in Ecuador. So
Ecuador
dollarized their economy during the 2000s in order to deal with inflation. So and actually was successful in dealing with inflation. Of course, they have other kind of problems right now, and could be related, probably or not, I don't know, with the currency scheme that they have. But dollarization could be one way to try to stabilize the economy. The thing that we found in our study, first, you have other 11 chances to get a stabilization plan.
Yeah, the dollarization was only one of the 12. So you have 11 other ways.
11 other ways. All the thing that, all those plans have in common that before doing the plan, they solve the fiscal deficit that the country has, and they also solve the problem that they have with the current account, with the export and imports flows. So it seemed for us that the thing that you have to do in order to increase the chance to have a successful stabilization plan is to do your job, that is to start dealing with the different disequilibrium, macroeconomic disequilibrium that the economy has. Of course, that's very difficult because if you have, if you have a very big fiscal deficit, to decrease that deficit, you need to or increase taxes or decrease expenses.
Both of them are politics.
Yeah, of course, but the thing is, someone is going to get hurt. Because someone is had to pay the taxes, or someone have to are not going to get the subsidies or the
service. Yeah.
So that's very. It's a problem. It's a problem actually in economy that you have with our poverty line, that is the national poverty line. We have the poverty ratio is more or less 46%.
Oh, it's so wow! High.
So. In an economy that we are not managing to grow since 2011, so it's more than one than 10 years without any kind of growth. That the real wages decreased since 2017, more or less 20%. And the inflation rate is so high, so everything is very conflicted because people have to deal with this decision. Okay, I'm buying this good that is very expensive, or you are trying to cheat me, and your markup is so high, and so on. It's very difficult to now ask people to make another effort and say, okay, now we are going to reduce the fiscal deficit, and you have to pay higher taxes. Of course, you can do it in a very try to do it in a very progressive way, but still it's going to be difficult. And the other thing that you have to solve is the problem that you have two different exchange rates, that you have the official exchange rate, the one where we use for buying our imports is so low, or were so low before the election of President Milei, and the black market exchange rate was so high. So if you want to close that gap, probably you need this big depreciation of the currency. And the big depreciation of the currency, it's going to mean that the prices of imports are going to increase. And most of the food that we buy in Argentina and so on are related with the import prices of the food.
Yeah, yeah.
So the cost of the food increase a lot with the depreciation, and because the cost of the food increase a lot of the depreciation means that a lot of people that were able to pay enough food and able to not be poor or to live in a good way now are going to face difficult to pay that. So it's very complicated to have a stabilization plan without, it's going to have costs for the society. But the thing is, if you don't try the stabilization plan, it's very difficult to start growing again. So it's like, the thing that I'm very worried, and I think that it's very important, is you need a lot of politics here.
Yeah. Dr. Palazzo, as you talk about fiscal deficit, here in America, we have that issue all the time. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that. In the next segment, we're going to talk about Argentina's national debt and its multiple defaults. We'll be right back.
We hope you are enjoying this podcast. And if you are, then why not treat us to a cup of coffee? That's right. For the price of a cup of coffee, you too can become a monthly supporter of the History Behind News podcast. We rely on your support to continue this program, to continue peeling the history behind our news. Supporting us is easy. Just click the support link in the detailed caption of this episode. And while you're there, check out the information about our guests and other attributions and links. And thank you.
Dr. Platt, so we talked about fiscal deficit in the last segment. So what is the national debt to GDP ratio in Argentina? For example, in the U.S., I have the September 2023 number. Our debt to GDP ratio was 123%. So we owe more than we make. But, you know, for example, in Japan, it's much, much higher than that. So what is it in Argentina?
It's lower.
It's lower. 84%, interesting.
85%. Yeah, you didn't expect that.
I did not at all. 85%?
85%, yes. But the thing, I mean, but it's the same in most of the developing country. I mean, the most important difference between the United States, Japan, and a country like Argentina is that your debt is issued in your own currency. So the debt in the United States is in dollars. The debt of Japan is in yen. So, but the debt in Argentina is not in convertible pesos. It's dollars too. So the thing is, in order to Argentina to repay their debt, you need to have a current account surplus, because you need to earn more from export than what you pay for imports. Because if you are not getting, if you don't have that, you can't pay for the debt, because you need to make dollars, you need to earn dollars in some way. So that means that maybe it's much more difficult for a country that issued debt in a foreign currency to repay their debt. So that means, that also means that, for example, in a situation as Argentina, nobody wants to lend us money because they are very worried if we are going to pay it back.
Yeah.
So that's never going to happen in the United States, because at the end, you can always issue more money and repay the debt. Your debt.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's some scholar call an exuberant privilege.
Privilege. Yeah, that we our economy runs on our own currency, and so yeah.
I mean, you that's good. I mean, you owe it. I mean, of course, people don't want to lend us money or to have it. Nobody wants to have a debt of Argentina that is in pesos, because they think that probably you are going to have inflation and they are going to lose money. So so that's something that, okay, we deserve it. I mean, in some way, it's the countries that manage in some way to issue debt in their own currency and investors want it, is because they're reliable, but not the Argentinian case.
You know, this question is a bit off topic, not that much, just a little bit. You mentioned exports, which makes sense. I mean, you're earning money for the nation, and then you get to have reserves and you get to service the debt and all sorts of things. I'm reluctant to ask this question, but I'm just so curious. What's the problem with Argentina having huge exports? This could be a whole podcast on its own. I appreciate that. Yeah.
No, it's a very interesting question. I mean, there is different opinions. Of course, our export amounts are not that high. I mean, if you compare with other countries and you compare the amount of export per capita, I mean, per population that we have, it's much less than Chile, for example. It's almost a half, I think.
And you're a much larger country with a higher population than Chile. Yeah.
Yeah. So the thing is, we have some sectors that are very productive, like, for example, the agriculture sector. But then we don't have all the sectors that are that productive and can compete in the world without any kind of protection. So I think, I mean, my personal opinion is about this is, export is a very difficult task, because you are competing with every country in the world, with every firm of the world. So people, I mean, you have to be very good to be able to export. I mean, you have commodities, of course. Some agricultural products are commodities, but if you want to export also industrial products or maybe some agricultural products but are more differentiated and it's not like commodity, you need to be very good at it. So probably you need some kind of policy that helps exporters to develop this differentiation, this upgrade product that you can sell to the rest of the world. And of course, in a country that it's very far from other parts of the world and from Europe, like the richer country of Europe or the United States, you have a lot of travel costs.
Transportation costs, yeah.
Yeah, so it's difficult. And the thing is, we are having very basic problems for someone that's being able to develop this, our export sector. We're never in the front page of the problems that politicians want to face. It's like, so we never have a very good industrial policy. We never have a very good export policy. You never have, I mean, we don't have a very good way to try to open markets to the exporters. And also, I think that probably the incentives in Argentina for the producer is to try to get some kind of protection, maybe tariff protection, and to sell to the domestic market, because it's much easier. And if you are able to do lobby and to increase the tariff rates and so on, maybe it's much more easy to try to sell a product that should not be a high quality product, because you are going to sell in a protected market, and to try and you don't care just to improve the quality to compete to the rest of the world. I mean, of course, there is a lot of
interesting,
but that would be the general. Yeah, the general behavior.
So when you have those tariffs, there's less incentive to innovate and increase the sort of quality of a product, because you no longer have to compete internationally. And the second thing is that's not contributing at all to the country's ability to service its debt to other countries, because you're not increasing exports.
That's true. If the tariff of inputs that you need for your final product is so high, also the cost of producing high quality products are going to be higher, because the inputs are very protected and paying very high tariffs. So it's also harming the competitiveness of the exporters.
Wow. Just in the minute we have left, and this is just, I'm curious, how many times has Argentina defaulted on its national debt? I asked this question because you said institutions and other countries are reluctant to lend to the government of Argentina because it may default or not give the money. Like,
honestly, I don't remember the true number, but I think that we're one of the worst country in the world that not paying our debt back. If I think on my own life, I can remember more than three times.
Oh my goodness.
So it's like, yeah.
And you're a young man. Wow, that's a lot. And I know they even defaulted back in the late 19th century or something like that. I remember reading this. Let's take a break here. Stay with me and Dr. Palazzo as we get into the perspective.
The History Behind News podcast is available on all your favorite podcast platforms. Of course, we love your reviews and ratings of our podcast, especially on Apple and Spotify. And remember, don't keep us to yourself. Tell a friend about the History Behind News podcast.
Dr. Palazzo, you mentioned developing economies, and you mentioned in the same sentence as Argentina, just so that we get it straight, is Argentina considered a developing country economy?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Okay, if that's the case, there's a bit of history here that I don't really understand, and maybe it's politics. In the early 20th century, many people thought that Argentina will become the next superpower. And I don't mean that like necessarily militarily, but as like, you know, an economic powerhouse. One, is that true? And two, what happened?
Oof, that's a difficult one. people said that the last century we were one of the biggest economies of the world, and then other people say that wasn't very true, and so on, and we have a lot of problems, and maybe that's the statistic we're not measuring very well, inequality, and so on. So the thing is, of course, in the past we were in a better path than right now.
Better path?
Path. I mean, Argentina is a developing country, but it still is a middle-income economy. And during most of this century, we were the richest economies in Latin America. Now we are not anymore. It's Chile, the richest economy in Latin America. I think that it's interesting if you ask to different scholars that do history when the Argentina start failing.
Yeah, yeah.
People are going to point different dates, and they're not going to agree. They're going to say, okay, the problem started in 1914, and other are going to say, no, it started in 1930, and the other one is going to say, no, it started in 1944 with Perón. Another one are going to say, no, it started in 1966 or 76. And so on. So there is so many different points or dates that people identify as the beginning of the problem in Argentina that that my feeling is, okay, we're having a lot of problems in different moments of a time, and it's very difficult to point just one. My favorite, and I think that was the moment that we start really diverging of the rest of Latin America is in the 70s. In the 70s, I think in the 70s it started again the capital flows around the world, because I mean it's called the second financial globalization, where the capital flows started to flow actually very fast against different countries, and countries get a load to get a lot of debt from other countries. I think that we didn't know, and we still don't know how to manage that in a smart way in order to do not have all the time debt crises and defaults and so on. I think that was a big problem for us, that we couldn't manage in a good way. Why? It's a big question. I don't know. The truth is probably is politics. But I think that that's a moment that until that moment, the history of the last century of Argentina was more or less similar to Latin America, in how we were growing and our progress of inflation and so on. But I think that after that moment, things start going very bad for Argentina.
Okay, after the 1970s.
Yeah.
Sort of Argentina missed the opportunity to enter the network of globalization and benefit from that.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of work on green growth. I'm intrigued by that. And you know, the last question that we talked about was a very important question, and you and I could talk about that for a long time, but I want to make sure I cover this so I'm not giving a short shrift in any way. So do you think, first of all, what do you mean by green growth?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. I mean, it's, for me, it's a very interesting topic, and it's more related to what I'm doing here at IBS. The thing is, I mean, in order to grow, You need to invest in those sectors that are going to grow faster in the future.
Yeah.
So my way to approach it, I mean, of course, we're in the middle of a climate crisis around the world. So, that's a very important context. But my approach is to think, okay, how developing countries can take advantage of this change of paradigm, of this change of the economic structure that should be going to be more green and invest in greener sectors and try to avoid the carbon emissions and so on. So probably there are some kind of sectors that are more related with this change, this structural change that it's happening and it's going to happen in the future. Because, I mean, just a very simple example, if you invest in the automobile and cars industry that are not green and not electrical, probably you are not going to sell your products, your cars, a lot in the future because nobody are going to demand that.
Yeah.
But if you manage to be a very big player in electrical cars, probably your producer, your exports are going to face a very high demand, and you are going to be able to grow a lot because of that. So the question is what are these green sectors and how a country like Argentina can take advantage of this and what we have to do. So that's I mean with the green economy.
What does Argentina have any infrastructure to enter the green energy or green growth industries?
And that's well, I think that we have two possibilities with this. No, the first one is the green world or the green economy are going to need a lot of minerals. No, are going to need a lot of lithium, a lot of nickel, a lot of copper, a lot of these coal critical minerals that are very important for the green transition. So one possibility in Argentina, one chance is to try to increase the export and the weight of these sectors in the economy, because we have a lot of lithium. I mean, Argentina have a lot of reserves of lithium. We have a lot of copper. No, so we have a lot of mineral potential. That's
one possibility. It can be a commodity exporter, and like for example, Chile exports copper, and that's important for their economy.
That could be a possibility, but still, most of the evidence points against that kind of specialization, because usually it's not very correlated with high growth. The case of Chile could be an atypical outlier, but still there's a lot of people that are saying, okay, Chile is not growing that much because of the copper. Chile is also growing a lot because of different kind of industries that they managed to develop using some kind of industrial policy or so on. But still, I mean, Chile, it's a very good example, a very good case that if I can replicate the case of Chile, I will be happy as Argentina, and I will be happy for my grandchildren.
Yeah.
The other possibility is to try to develop other kind of sectors that are more complex, that are more modern, that probably are more industrial sector and more related with for example, cars, electrical cars. But the thing is, countries like Argentina or Brazil do not have very strong comparative advantages in that kind of sectors. So if you want to go to that in that way, for sure, it's not only the market, the one that are going to help go there, because you have to manage to develop infrastructure, to develop capabilities, to develop a skill force that are able to produce that. So probably you need that the government plays a role there, maybe not very important, but for sure it should have played a role there to try to help you to specialize in those sectors. And of course, in a country in Argentina that are having a macroeconomic crisis, an inflation crisis, and we're saying, okay,
yeah,
it's very, very difficult to think how we can manage to adjust or reduce our fiscal deficit and at the same point making a very strong program favoring some kind of sectors that to do a very smart industrial policy, you need a very capable state with a bureaucracy, very skillful and so on.
This goes back to the conversation we were having about, we were talking about exports and you were saying it's very hard for the government to prioritize or at least bring it to the front sort of industrial forces that could augment exports. So prioritizing green growth is similar to that. Before we end our conversation, as I mentioned earlier, you moved from the University of Buenos Aires, and now you're in Brighton, Southeast England at IDS. Could you tell us what IDS is? I'm intrigued here.
Well, IDS is associated to the University of Sussex. It's an independent center that is called Institute of Development Studies.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's a research center that also have a master and trying to understand how developing countries could manage to deal with all the problems that we have that are not only economics problem. I mean, there are some economists here, but also socialists, sociologists, anthropologists, people that study history, people that study politics, and so on. And the thing that we try to do is to be very interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary and try to study problems in a very open mind way to get the best of each discipline to understand the problems of our world that are a lot, because developing countries, I mean, despite that probably during the last 50 years we have a lot of improvements in how people are living around the world, we still have problems in several different aspects.
Of course, when you say developing countries, that's like, you know, so many countries. Does IDS have a focus geographically or no?
As far as I know, no.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, of course, the relationship in England with Africa is more closer than the relationship with South America or Latin America, but still I'm here and I'm trying to do studies about Latin America and about how come Latin America can take advantage of the green economy and so on. So I think that they don't have a preference or a focus in particular. Yeah.
Is this a fellowship for you or is this kind of like a permanent position?
It's a permanent position. Yeah.
It's a permanent. Well, I wish you all the luck in your research, and hopefully, in another year, we'll talk again, and you'll have some sort of solution for your home country, Argentina. Dr. Palazzo, thank you so much for educating me and our listeners. And to our listeners, if you know of any history that could provide more perspective from the past on this subject, please share it with us and tell us what's your perspective. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
The opinions and statements of our guests are their own. We neither agree nor disagree with them. We're only interested in the perspective they provide through history. At History Behind News, we're honored that our guests share their expertise with us, most of which are based on years of scholarship and research. And we provide links to their projects and publications for your benefit to review them if you wish. Otherwise, we're not affiliated with our guests. We just think they teach us pretty cool history, the history behind our news. Also, unless we explicitly inform you, we're not affiliated with any institutions, including Amazon, for which book links are shared here from time to time for your convenience. Finally, as a reminder, we don't do news here at History Behind News. We peel the news for the history behind it. And our mission is not to provide a complete account and analysis of the past, Rather, it's to highlight some issues and incidents in our history that may poke and prod your discerning minds into seeking some perspective for our news. And if you disagree with our take on history, well then, it means we've succeeded in getting you to think about the history behind news. And of course, share your thoughts with me by leaving your comments on Twitter or sending an email to adele@historybehindnews.com. I love to hear from you. I love to learn from you. Until next time, this is Adele with History Behind News, a history podcast for our news.